I just wanted to take a quick moment and fill in some thoughts, some scattered factual things about the history of the theory of freedom and Western political theory, things that occurred to me based on a conversation that we recently had, and I didn't want to let the thoughts go because maybe some of you will find them interesting and the rest of you skip it. My thought came out of this conversation, which I think is really important, where someone brought up what I would call the basic negative idea of freedom, the idea that freedom just means not being constrained. I was reading over Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom. He has the same idea. It's not surprising that this is what most of us think because this is the dominant ideology, and it's also something that's real. One easy response to it is that, of course, there is no such thing as absolute freedom in this negative sense. Not only is gravity always operating on me, and my life is short, and there are various natural things which limit the activities of which I'm capable, but of course, some things that some of us might want to do would be a problem for other people who would not like them done to them. And so there's this classic basic idea that says, well, my ability to throw my fist around should end at your chin, right? I can act freely so long as I don't interfere with you and impede your freedom. And this is a basic liberal idea of freedom as existing for the individual within a context where the freedom of various individuals are mutually limiting with respect to one another. Now, I would say to begin with, this is something desirable to a certain extent, and the critique of it, that it has to be limited, is sort of built in. Let me specify a little bit more a couple of attitudes towards this, and then I want to say that it's insufficient and that there are other ways to talk about freedom and other ways that people do talk about freedom, and it's good to have a number of them in mind so that we become more capable of really posing the question and determining for ourselves when we think it's properly answered. So to become more specific even about this negative idea of freedom, I wanted to point out that, interestingly, I think it exists in both what would now be codified as hard right, libertarian perspectives, and hard left, anarchist perspectives. I think they agree about this negative dimension of freedom to some extent. Maybe a specification first. We don't, of course, actually worry about being constrained by gravity, or by, maybe we worry sometimes about locked doors and fences, but only insofar as they signify the decisions made by other people to prevent us going from where we might like or need to go. The ultimate concern about freedom here is not about the natural world operating on us, it's about other people operating on us. So this notion of freedom, I think primarily it's really about the wish not to be controlled by others. The freedom of the individual or the freedom of the group seems, first of all, to have to do with non-compulsion by other social actors, either individual or collective. And this is the view that I think both libertarians and like Bakunin share. The difference, even at this level, between libertarians and anarchists, and a place that, honestly, I just think the libertarians really fall short, is that while they agree that nobody ought to boss me around, you know, like the don't tread on me flag has we know that as a libertarian symbol in our world, but it's also, you know, works okay for a lot of anarchists, and especially anarchists who understand their anarchism in what I would call a primarily negative sense, not like a bad sense, but in terms of they want to push constraint off. They think of anarchism as doing away with coercion and authority. And it certainly, anarchism involves that. I don't know if you can come up with anything that is properly an anarchism that is cool with authority. But there is a fundamental difference between these positions, this right position and this left position, and it has to do with property. The place where I would fault libertarians is in thinking that they can, on the one hand, insist that they will live free or die, And that they should not be treaded on, and that the government should back off. And, you know, the best government is one that governs least. You know, Thoreau is probably a kind of figure that straddles both of these traditions. They hold that position, and yet they also hold the position that part of the freedom that they want is the freedom to have property and to have big property. And there may be a confusion in a whole lot of the American populace who thinks this way, where they think about their property. They don't want anybody to mess with their car. Maybe they have land or a house. They don't want anybody to mess with that. And yet the legal system, which is set up to protect property, actually operates primarily to protect big property. And there's no critique from the libertarian perspective about big property either. This is how you get relatively poor white folks, one way that you get relatively poor white folks, probably some Mexican folks and others as well, on the same side as General Motors and Exxon. They think that what they want is maximum freedom. They think that freedom means their activities and their behaviors, but also their stuff ought not to be interfered with. But perhaps they're making a mistake about who their real allies are and what is the real function of property. This is where the Bakunin style anarchist tradition is really distinguished from the libertarian one, and that is that for this anarchist view, property itself is a form of social compulsion. If property exists, and that does not mean like if I have a pen or if you have your shirt, but I think the moment that one of us owns a house that we can rent doesn't have to be huge property, but the moment that I have a house aside from my own, and maybe even the moment I have my own house, I am engaged in a relation of either exploitation or exclusion with respect to other people. Now, even the fact that I own a house or that I share that ownership with the bank, my control over this property and the services that it can provide, the shelter that it can provide, especially at this time as we're all worried about going out in public and being sick. So long as I control this property, other people can't be here. Property is not just an individual relation. It's not just about me and my stuff. It's about me and other people. This is increasingly clear if you start looking at, if I own not only my own house, but another one, there are people in this city, many people, most people, who don't own a house. And because they exist, they are compelled by economic necessity, by practical necessity, to go and rent from someone who has that house. My owning that house then puts me in a position to draw their rent. And when I take the rent that they made by working for some other owner of property, a business owner, I take their value and I put it into my equity. So owning property puts me in a structurally superior position with respect to other people, such that I have the ability now to draw value from them and use it to augment my position. Meanwhile, the renter spends in the month and then has to come back the next month and do the same thing again, and in most cases isn't able to accumulate anything. This is exponentially true if we start talking about really big property, big capital, which is capable of investing in a region or divesting in a region, causing people to have jobs or taking away those jobs, determining things about the land and the possibilities of disease that surround poorer communities. Big property isn't separate from the question of freedom. It's central to it. Big property is not independent of coercion. It is a fundamental, rudimentary, and at the largest scale, foundational form of coercion over others. So the anarchist view is that, yeah, we want freedom in the sense of negativity, like, you know, get out of my face, don't tell me what to do. But we also understand that so long as there exists private property in capitalism, we don't have that freedom. That's the difference between libertarians and anarchists, even though they probably can still, you know, have a beer together until they realize that they disagree. Okay, I just wanted to add, in addition to that, there are other ways of looking at freedom. So it's not just enough to think that freedom is the absence of constraint. The absence of constraint seems important only insofar as I want to or we want to do something. So now we can ask the question, freedom to do what? That's positive freedom. I want to develop my capacities. I want to be able to live in a particular way. I want to be able to make particular things. I want to be able to be with particular people. These are all positive activities. If I am in a circumstance of, you know, total non-compulsion with respect to other people, I have a whole lot of money and I live on an island or whatever, but I don't have any capacities and I don't have any interests, it would be hard to call me totally free. I'm not the most impressive person, and I'm stuck in my own lethargy. If all I do is play video games all day and I'm not even very good at them, I doubt that you should really call me the freest individual. Freedom seems also to involve self-determination. I am free to do certain things, and my freedom maybe centers on certain capacities and certain practices. I think this is important to think about. We're going to talk about this more in the future. It's related to Aristotle, and it's related to the cultural nationalist and the post-colonial nationalist traditions that you can find in like Stokely Carmichael and in Frantz Fanon. You know, in Aristotle, I'm not free just because nobody stops me doing what I do. My freedom has to involve my thinking through a goal that I want, figuring out how to get it, and then doing it, right? This is a particular activity. My freedom consists in the performance of a particular activity, which according to Aristotle is natural to me as a human being, and we might extend this out to social groups and formations too. Okay, this leads me to think about other forms of freedom. You know, for one thing, you know, the person who is super rich and lives on an island and but never does anything is free, but only in sort of a weak sense. On the other hand, I mean, we can look at, say, an incarcerated population, and we could probably still, you know, even if they are all equally incarcerated, they're equally stuck, they're kept in the same, you know, areas of the prison. Maybe they're going to do the same time or whatever, we could probably still distinguish between more and less free people, even in that population. And now in terms of constraint, the presence or absence of constraint, from the perspective of negative freedom, that doesn't really make much sense. But I think it's real. What I mean is that you could see some people who are just beaten by that system, by that context, by the authorities that are over them and the other forms of authority that exist within the prison. They are retracted, and they're just trying to get out without getting hurt, which is fair enough. But then you can see other people who remain defiant and who are pushing to use that time in order to educate themselves, in order to organize the other people in the prison. You know, think about George Jackson or Malcolm X. Now, those people we think of as notable figures in the history of liberation. They were incarcerated. And even though they were incarcerated, I think there is a meaningful way in which we can say that they remained free. So freedom there doesn't have to do with the absence of constraint. We all have constraint, and the people in the prison have something approaching maximum constraint. And yet freedom still operates even in the presence of constraint. So it seems insufficient simply to define freedom as the absence of something when we can see that certain individuals, even presented with all kinds of coercion and hardship, end up being freer individuals than people who lack those forms of coercion. Now, we can push this really far, and there's a question, you know, how far should we go? One way that we could push it really far is to go, say, into existentialism. So Jean-Paul Sartre, who was friends with Fanon, is famous for emphasizing freedom, and he thinks that freedom is the essence of all human beings. And freedom has to do with, like in Aristotle, with the capacity of choice. But then you have this existentialist presentation of the experience and the character of choice, which also recasts freedom. And I think this is worth talking over very quickly. The basic idea in Sartre is, or one basic idea, is that freedom is a burden. Freedom's not just a happy thing. We all are free, meaning that we all have to choose. We have to choose what we're going to do this very second. We have to choose what we're going to do tomorrow. And if you start to think about that, you might want to resist it. You might want to say, well, you know, really, because I'm a working class person, I don't have any choice. I have to go to work. But of course, there are, I mean, I think this is a small minority in the homeless population, but I have actually spoken to homeless people who would rather not work, right? I don't mean to characterize the homeless population as if it were a freely chosen population, but that choice can be made, right? And there are plenty of us who would rather not work and sometimes choose not to work. even the things that we think we are not choosing, this is the existentialist position, we do choose. Even though we don't want to have to choose, we do choose. Even though we don't have enough, and this is kind of an existentialist leap, this comes from Kierkegaard, really, beyond Aristotle and the sort of rationalist tradition. You know, in the rationalist tradition, my freedom and my self-determination have pretty much everything to do with reasoning. But what you get in Kierkegaard going into Sartre is this important recognition that actually, if you look at it carefully, every time I make a choice, my choice is underdetermined. Meaning I don't actually have enough data, I don't have enough knowledge to know for sure what is the absolute right thing to do in any circumstance. And if I did, maybe you shouldn't even really call that a choice. All of our real choices are undetermined. The way that Kierkegaard puts it, there is in each case a leap from my incomplete knowledge into action. And this is what distinguishes a notable and unique and powerful individual, what in Kierkegaard would be called the Knight of Faith, from other people, is that they make an art of this leaping. You know, in Sartre, he says, most people don't want to admit that they're free. They don't want to admit that they make choices. And so they pretend various things in order to hide their own choices from themselves. For example, I can do this in a couple of ways. Say I'm trying to make a decision, which is really important. I'm not sure what to do, and so I'm going to consult some people who I respect. Sartre tells this whole story about, now, who are you going to choose? And if you actually think about who you choose to give you advice, isn't that sort of choosing the path that you're going to follow? You know, if I ask a priest, I'm going to get one answer about what I should do. If I ask my mother, I'll get another. If I ask a certain friend, I'll get a third, and so on. In choosing other people who I'm going to ask for guidance, I'm actually choosing for myself, but I'm not admitting that I'm doing it because freedom is a burden, and it's an infinite burden. I always have to choose, and I'm never sure that my choice is the right thing, even though my choices have effects not only on me, but on everyone around me in a whole bunch of ways, not just immediate consequences, but insofar as every time I choose, I model something for my son. I model something for my friends. I am responsible for giving them the message that this is how one ought to act. I am infinitely free. I am infinitely responsible. This is heavy. This is hard. This is happening in the real world where, like, the things I have to choose between are all set up in these systems of constraint. I would rather it were not so. It would be easier were it not so, and yet it is so. So in Sartre, I'm infinitely free, right? Now we can move from that on to, let's say, another version of freedom as negativity. I'm thinking of the Frankfurt School. This idea comes especially from Hegel. And in the Frankfurt School, which overlaps with existentialism, in the Frankfurt School, freedom is something that relates to understanding fundamentally and imagining, thinking, dialectical thinking specifically. And this thinking, this ability to imagine the world in a way other than what it is, and thus to sort of shift our actions so that we can make other choices, this capacity to recognize that the world that we are given is, and the way that it is presented to us, is not how it has always been, not how it will always be. And in fact, our interpretation of it right now is never the totality, is never the reality of how the world is even right now. We're given ideas of what the world is, what's natural about the world, but we have to somehow get a distance from that in order to be able to really make choices, in order to move towards alternative futures. The focus, one focus of the Frankfurt School, and here I'm referencing specifically Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno, The Dialectic of Enlightenment, and Marcuse's One-Dimensional Man. In both those books, you'll find a critique that in our world, extreme efforts are made to prevent us from being able to think and being able to imagine in this way. We're operated upon so profoundly by educational systems, I would call these ideological state apparatuses, by media systems. And the functioning of those systems in large measure is to convince us. They are ideological systems. They're there to convince us that this is the only way that the world can be. The world that you find around you, the jobs that are available to you, the language that you speak, the political system that exists over you, the prison system that is around you, the policing that is watching you, is really the only system that could possibly exist. There are different ways to try and convince you of this. This is the best that anybody has ever had it. This is the apogee of freedom in the world. The United States and the level of technology that has been achieved in the global north are the most comfortable and convenient and luxurious form of life that anyone has ever had. You can make the whole thing look really desirable, or you can do it in a negative way. You can say, like, look, okay, it might be a bummer that the cops are watching you all the time. It might be a bummer that your cousin is in prison, but we have to have these coercive state apparatuses because if we don't, everybody will kill one another. That's sort of a negative view, right? But so long as we internalize these ideological notions which prevent us from looking away from what is actual, from what is given, and from the way that it is given to us, so long as we don't move away from that in thought, we are going to be the kind of people who reaffirm that system. It's necessary for the system to convince us that the way things are is the totality of the way that things can be. Ideology functions to make the actual look like the totality of the possible, but it's not. And so real imagination, criticality, real thought, dialectical thought, which for these purposes I would call moving back and forth between, you know, your immediate experiences, these different parts of the world that we come into contact with, and the whole that we can only think, right? But which is probably there in one way or the other, whether it's closed or not. These are other questions, like metaphysical questions. But there certainly is more to the world than what you or I are experiencing right now or what we ever will experience. And so the critical imagination, which is also the capacity for revolutionary thought, depends on our ability to be the negativity that we really are. This is the fundamental fact for them, and this is the overlap between existentialism and like Frankfurt School Hegelianism about humanity, is that we are capable both of being and being present with whatever it is that we're seeing and hearing and smelling, but also of not being those very things. Thought begins, and this is also like actually Adorno's aesthetic theory, art begins. Imagination begins, but also politics begins and revolution begins with the capacity to say, yeah, I'm supposedly me. This is supposedly this. This world is supposedly natural, but hold on a second. That moment where I go, but hold on a second, and I move into reflection and I start thinking, but couldn't things be otherwise? That's the moment of thought and that's the moment of freedom. That's what they will call negativity. I am capable of negating all that is or all that is given to me at any given time in order to step back and recontextualize that thing that is given in terms of the things that I have experienced, that I can imagine, right? And then this freedom is aided by our capacity to think clearly and by our knowledge of history and comparative politics. You know, the moment that you can say, like, look, that's the way it is here, but over here it's some other way. That act of cognitive comparison, it reduces the power of the system that is operating on you right now, the perception that you're having right now. The idea that this is the only thing that we have, if you've been to another country, that will operate on you in a weaker way. So these are devices, these are facts, these are types of experience, and education is so tightly related to these things, which make the negativity or freedom, which we are, more possible. Okay, so those are just some other models of freedom that are floating around and maybe we can think about. The place I wanted to finish up, though, is still related to freedom, but maybe it's as closely related to power. On my read, freedom and power might be the same thing. I mean, you know, my final formulations on this matter are not complete. You know, I got to make a class to think it through, and you all are helping me. But what I wanted to say is the key model that I want to start thinking about and that a lot of the readings for the rest of the class are related to goes something like this. You know, this is in Deloria. It's in Wildcat. It's in Marx. It's in Hannah Arendt. It's for me, it's importantly in Spinoza, although I didn't give you Spinoza because Spinoza feels really abstract and hard to read for most people. I guess what I'm offering is that real freedom, first of all, is going to have to be practical. That means it's going to have to be connected with action and a particular place, a particular space, a particular time, which is now. You know, Stokely Carmichael says this, you know, if not you, then who? If not now, then when? It's only in these real places that real freedom, if we don't conceive of freedom as something that is going to be achieved, you know, like at the end of history or something like that, these are the only places where freedom could happen. And so we have to think about freedom in terms of our real, emplacedness within physical contexts. What I want to suggest is that the whole problem of power and freedom for us has to do with alienation versus connection, or separation versus connection. And we're going to see this iterated in a whole bunch of different ways, and that's one of the things I want to show you exists in these different traditions. We exist in real contexts. We exist surrounded by real people. We exist passed through by an indefinite number of real processes. And yet, for the most part, we are disconnected from all of those things. So I would like to suggest beginning to think about freedom in terms of our connection to or disconnection from the real things that are around us, the real people that are around us, the real processes in which we are involved. You can find this, if you think back to Aristotle, we could either be in full possession of our reasoning powers, connected to our capacity, and have our thought connected to our action, or we could be disconnected from those things. If you live in a society of experts, or if you go through authoritarian schools, if you are always somewhere down the chain in terms of management at a job, you become accustomed to not making decisions for yourself. I think we are a society that is, by and large, you know, with some exception for trivial and, well, certainly narrow managerial tasks where we tell one person what to do, but on the basis of what someone else told us what to do, we're largely separated from our decision-making capacity. It seems to me a very desirable and even revolutionary process to give us back the capacity for politics, which would mean to put us back into immediate contact with our decision-making capacity. Or another thing, you know, like we talked about the tendency of the academy, the tendency of academics in general to figure stuff out, but not to act on it. In Aristotle, that was called incontinence, right? If you have your mental capacities nominally intact and you can think through a whole bunch of complex stuff, and even if this complex stuff involves the world that really surrounds you, if you don't translate that knowledge into action upon that world, you're still unfree. Freedom seems to have to do, in this case, with reconnecting our thought and our action. We're going to see this in a whole bunch of different ways. We saw all kinds of disconnections in Marcuse, separations between my mind and my body, separations between who I am and what I do, separations between who I really am, the interiority, and the world outside. Okay, so we're going to look through this in a whole bunch of different ways. You know, how am I disconnected from the things around me? And maybe this is actually a more complex thing because I guess our disconnections from things around us are largely experiential and perceptual and cognitive. You know, there are many things that are around me that I am not aware of or that I do not act on, and yet these things act upon me. Right, so we are being acted upon by a context which we are dissociated from, which we are numb to, and maybe that's the problem. If the problem is disconnection or alienation in all these different ways, then it seems pretty simple and logical to me to say that the solution, which will be the practice of freedom, lies in reconnection. I have to identify the things around me. I have to identify my own capacities. I have to identify my own people, those who can be my friends. I have to identify these things and I have to reconnect with them. And as I reconnect with my environment, sometimes I'll run into things that can make me stronger and that will increase my capacity to do certain things, which I think is a positive notion of freedom. But I can also run into things which decrease my capacity to act, right? There are things around us which actually hurt us. Toxic waste, you know, arsenic in the air, all kinds of stuff. So reconnecting with the world is not like necessarily a happy process. I think we've talked about this, that there are so many ways in which coercive systems operate upon us that most people don't even want to think about it. There are so many toxins in the air. There are so many plastics in our water that we would rather not think about them. And yet doing anything for the generations ahead of us, making it possible for humanity, much less free humanity, to exist in a couple of generations, definitely requires that we reconnect with those things. So the model of freedom that I want to offer has to do with this process of real, local, and now connection with the things that are around us.